So I wanted to start by saying a huge thank you to Sylvie for enormous work, actually, over 2 or 3 months now of really paying attention to all the details that have helped all of us to arrive here relatively smoothly and with as little frazzledness as possible, because it is a challenge getting all of us here for retreat. And I know from having managed retreats myself in the past, just the incredible amount of details that go into running something that seems relatively straightforward. So huge bow of appreciation to you for really dedicatedly making this possible. Thanks. And of course, thanks to all of you for showing up, because again, it takes a surprising amount of effort to extricate from our lives and to step out of our usual responsibilities. And I just wanted to even begin by taking a moment to think for yourselves about that process and to maybe acknowledge some of the people who aren't here but who have made it possible for you to be here. Perhaps some of your family and partners and friends and neighbors and workmates, cast of quite a few people made it possible. Just a moment of silent acknowledgement to them for their support. So touching in and getting a sense of how many different beneficial causes and conditions have to come together to make a retreat like this possible. Support from family and friends, and the support of this environment, which is powerful. And I know that many of you have been here before and have developed quite a sense of connection to this incredible landscape. So we're very fortunate to have access to this land. And I'd like to acknowledge that this retreat is being held on Aboriginal land, the traditional lands of the Darug and Gundungurra people, and to just recognize the strength and the capacity and the resilience of past and present Aboriginal people in this region. So we can appreciate the traditional owners for their care for this land, and we can appreciate the current custodians, Malcolm and Nara, who run this retreat center with the aspiration that it be a place to cultivate spiritual friendship. And we can acknowledge our own particular lineages too, our own ancestors and forebears, our history and our culture, and perhaps for some of us, the lineage of our own Dharma teachers. So speaking of tradition, in New Zealand, where I grew up, usually it's when people speak in public, before they speak, they introduce themselves in quite a specific way so that people know where they're coming from, both literally and metaphorically, getting a sense of who they are. So for example, people of Maori heritage, they'll recite their genealogy, their family history, and they'll talk about the mountain and the river that they feel a sense of connection to as a way of connecting with other people in the room. And in a similar way, New Zealanders of non-Maori background, they might introduce themselves in broadly similar ways with that same intention of creating connection and helping others to know where they're coming from. So because I don't know all of you yet, I know many of you, but not everyone, I thought just to give a little bit of my background so you know, in quotation marks, a little bit about where I'm coming from. So my name is Jill Shepherd, and I was brought up originally in the UK, emigrated to New Zealand when I was 10, so I have dual British New Zealand nationality, and then I moved to Australia in 1997. And I managed an insight meditation center just up the road here in Medlow Bath, the Blue Mountains Insight Meditation Center for about 3 years. Then I moved on to the US to live and work at a big meditation center in this same tradition, the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, which was founded by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg, who I think many of you are familiar with. And then last year I graduated from a 4-year teacher training that was jointly put together by IMS and Spirit Rock on the West Coast. And since 2012, I've technically been homeless. I just travel around the world wherever I'm invited to teach, which is mostly the US, Australia, New Zealand, sometimes Europe and Britain. And I say technically homeless because the experience is more like being home full, because I have these different communities and connections around the world where I land on a regular basis. And I really appreciate being able to connect with these different communities of people who have this common interest in really understanding how to live their lives in ways that lead to more ease, to happiness, to freedom. And I've seen for myself how this orientation towards freedom affects not only the people in the immediate community, but in our wider lives as well. So just to say up front that all of this effort that we're doing here over this week, it's not for ourselves alone. And already here we are in this temporary community, this community that's come together to explore the freeing power of meditation. And because we're quite a big group, unfortunately, we don't have time for each of us to introduce ourselves at this point, because I know for many of you it's been a very long day already, and I'd really like to try and keep this evening somewhat short. So just to acknowledge that each of you, of course, you've come from different parts of Australia, perhaps different parts of the world. You each have your own culture and heritage and rich life experience. And I hope that each of you will feel welcome in this temporary community that we're creating together. Feel welcome to bring the whole of who you are. Perhaps even those parts that you might think don't belong or shouldn't be seen in some way. So there's a short haiku poem from the Zen tradition that some of you may know that for me captures this sense of wholeness very beautifully. It's by a female poet, Izumi Shikibu, who lived in the 10th century. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. And I wanted to start with that poem because it's really an invitation to come into, to come here to try and arrive here as fully and completely as we can, no part left out. And I know during the course of this retreat, we'll be experiencing a full moon. So perhaps when you see it at night, it might be a visual reminder to just remember that invitation to come here fully, no part left out. Even those parts that right now might feel perhaps just a little anxious or apprehensive, uncertain, unsure. Because whether you're new to insight meditation, whether you've been practicing for years or even decades, it's still true that often the first few hours of a retreat can be a little unsettling. Just that transition, coming out of our ordinary lives and then arriving here with this group of mostly unfamiliar people and beginning to move into this more inward, contemplative way of being. So to help with this transition, I'd like to take some time to really establish a strong container for our practice together so that we can really make the most of it. And when I use the word container, sometimes I think of a woven basket. It's a little like we're weaving a basket together, and each one of us is a strand of that basket, and together we're stronger than we might be individually. So we can weave together a basket. Like in Maori culture, they have these beautiful kete kits made out of flax that they keep their treasures in, their taonga. And so I think in some ways that what we're doing here is creating one of those baskets to begin to explore our own inner treasure. In some Buddhist traditions, they talk about our Buddha nature. So you could think of our Buddha nature as being our highest potential as human beings. That capacity is already within us. But for most of us, it takes a little bit of polishing to be able to see it clearly. And that's what we'll be doing here on this retreat, is going inwards, looking inwards, cultivating what's good, what's of true value. So if we put this in more traditional Buddhist terms that some of you might be familiar with, we can think of this as an aspect of taking refuge. In the Buddhist tradition, before any period of intensive meditation like this, we're invited to take refuge in what are known as the three jewels. So again, we have that idea of treasure. And these three jewels are the Buddha himself, the Dharma, or the truth, his teachings, and the Sangha, the community of people who are exploring these teachings. So these are the three jewels. And taking refuge in them is an invitation. So it's just an encouragement for you to find your own way of relating to what they represent. Because I know for myself that when I first heard about this concept of taking refuge, I had a little bit of a reaction to it. A sense of, I don't need to take refuge. I'm an independent person. I don't need anything to be dependent on. But what I didn't realize back then was that actually I was always or often taking a refuge in something, whether I knew it or not. And it's just true for most people. When we get stressed or distressed, we look for comfort, for solace, for escape. And often, if we're not very aware, the refuges that we turn towards are not very helpful, at least not in the long term. So for example, many of us these days take refuge in busyness and overwork. Sometimes in substances, alcohol or drugs or other kinds of addictions to shopping or sex or computers or food. Or there's so many different ways that we can use to disconnect. And some of these things in themselves are not necessarily toxic, but the way we relate to them is what's problematic. If we're using them as strategies to avoid dealing with reality, with the truth of how things are, then eventually they're going to let us down. So these things might be temporary refuges, but some of them are also quite toxic in the long run, because they get in the way of clear seeing, of insight. And that's what we're trying to cultivate here. So in the Buddha's teachings, he offered a different kind of refuge, one that does help with clear seeing, one that helps us to see through delusion and to wake up. Because this word Buddha actually means awake. So it's said that after the Buddha had the realization that led to his full awakening, Nibbana, somebody asked him, well, who are you? Are you a human? Are you a god? And he simply said, I'm awake. He'd woken up out of delusion. And so when we're invited to take refuge in the Buddha, you could think of it as this orientation towards cultivating our highest human potential, just as the Buddha did 2,600 years ago. So this is not though, about cultivating some kind of dependent relationship, what we're doing is orienting towards his example of deeply understanding our own hearts and minds so that we can live with more ease and freedom in the world. This is living in alignment with the truth of how things are rather than how we wish they were. And this is the aspect of the Dhamma. One way that the Dhamma is sometimes translated is as the truth, the natural law of how things are. It's also a reference to the Buddha's teachings themselves. So when we take refuge in the Dhamma, we're orienting to the truth of how things are and to understanding the teachings that lead us there. So then we also have the refuge of the Sangha, the community of people who are oriented in that same way. And as I think all of you know, we really need the moral support of other people who are trying to follow this practice, because many of the values of mainstream society are not so helpful for this turning inwards, this wish to develop wisdom and compassion. So we traditionally take refuge in the Sangha. But I also, particularly in relation to Sangha, think of we're offering Sangha to each other. So it's a two-way relationship. By showing up and being here, we're offering each other the gift of Sangha as well as receiving that gift for ourselves. Because I don't know about you, but if you are sitting here by yourself right now, looking at sitting and walking every day for the next week, I'm not sure how easy it would be to maintain that momentum. But having this company of people who are at times literally walking alongside you is a very powerful way of maintaining the momentum of the practice. So we're all in this together, and together we create something that's stronger than our individual practice. So we have the support of these three jewels, taking refuge in them, and then we have the commitment to what's known as noble silence, which, as I think most of you know, means not speaking to each other unless it's absolutely necessary in a job situation or something. But also, to some extent, minimizing eye contact and not reading or writing except for brief notes about your meditation practice, and not using mobile phones or electronic devices. And just to say that in, you know, ordinary society, silence is sometimes used as a way of punishing people. So for some of us, it can have somewhat unpleasant connotations. But the kind of silence that we're offering each other here is really done with warmth. It's done in the spirit of friendship. And what makes it noble is that it's done with the purpose of helping us to go inwards, to really see our own hearts and minds clearly so that we can free ourselves from unhelpful habits. So this gift of giving each other silence allows us to befriend ourselves more deeply. And through that befriending, when we come out of the silence of the other side, we're then able to befriend others more deeply too, because we've got to know ourselves, we understand ourselves better, then we can offer others the gift of friendship on a deeper level. So please, just as an invitation to do your best to put aside the usual technology and the usual ways of interacting and really give each other this gift. So sometimes I think starting a retreat like this is a bit like setting off on a journey or a voyage of some kind. It can feel a bit like we're launching a ship. It even looks a bit like an upside down ship. So here we are in this boat. We might not know exactly where we're headed, but we can think of the three refuges as being in some ways like stars that we can navigate by. And if I might stretch that navigation metaphor a little bit, the five precepts we might think of, these commitment to ethical conduct, we can think of them as being like those navigation lights. You know, in a channel in the harbor, we have red and green. And if you steer between the lights, you're not going to run aground. So again, traditionally at the start of a retreat, we make this formal commitment to non-harming. And all of these five precepts are rooted in this intention to not cause harm to ourselves or others through actions of body, of speech, and of mind. And again, the Buddha talked about this commitment to non-harming as an expression of generosity. He said it's a gift, a great gift. It's a gift of fearlessness. Because others have nothing to fear from us when we have this commitment to non-harming. And in the same way, we have nothing to fear from others because we're living a life of blamelessness. We're not living in fear of being punished or found out and so on. So I think most of you are familiar with these five precepts. But I'll go into them in just a little bit more detail before we take them together, because as with many of the Buddha's teachings, they can be approached on more and more refined levels. So at first, as the traditional expression is as a list of things that we undertake not to do. So to refrain from killing living beings, to refrain from stealing, to refrain from using our sexual energy in ways that are harmful, to refrain from harsh and false speech, and to refrain from taking intoxicants. So these are the five traditional basic guidelines. Welcome, would you like to come into the center of the room? I'm glad you could make it. Yes, just so you can see. You're not hidden too much behind other people. So we have these five precepts, and you know, in my own experience, it can be easy to think, well, of course I'm not going to kill things, I'm not going to steal things. And we can think of them as just a kind of formula that we get through at the start of a retreat. But more recently, I've started to understand the importance of having a strong ethical foundation for our meditation practice. And I think one reason it took me a long time to come to this was in the West, the way we've taken these teachings, we put a lot of emphasis on meditation and not so much on the other foundations of the practice. And I think most of us have some sense, hope, or belief that we meditate in order to that our lives will change, but we don't always see so clearly the other direction, that we need to change our lives in order for our meditation to deepen. Because meditation doesn't happen in a vacuum. It really is a two-way relationship, and what we do with the rest of our lives has a big impact on what happens when we sit down to meditate. So I think in the West so far we've put a lot of emphasis on meditation and not so much on the sila, the ethical conduct. And this disconnect was noticed by one of Joseph Goldstein's first teachers, Munindraji. So not long after IMS first opened, Joseph invited Munindraji to come and teach there, and have the sense that Joseph was quite proud of this center and all these Westerners doing their meditation practice. And he asked Munindraji what he thought of these new Western meditators. And apparently Munindraji said he was impressed by their dedication to getting enlightenment, but their efforts were undermined by a lack of understanding of ethical behavior. And he said it was a bit like watching people who were trying to row their boat across the river. They were putting a lot of effort into rowing and rowing and rowing, but they hadn't actually untied their boat from the dock, so they weren't getting anywhere. So at first we might approach these training precepts in a fairly superficial way, just a checklist of what we're supposed to not do. But as the practice develops, we start to see how even quite minor misconduct, it has a big impact. And as our commitment to ethical conduct gets more refined, we see the benefits in terms of more stability of mind, of calmness and concentration and clarity. And in turn, that calm clarity, it really helps us to see when we're acting unskillfully in maybe more refined ways. So as the precepts and our practice of them develops, they move from being the negative expression of what not to do towards their positive expression of what we can do. So for example, not just refraining from killing living beings, but actively working to cultivate reverence for all forms of life. And the dedication to non-harming then has a positive expression as compassion. And the second precept, the invitation to refrain from taking what has not been given, in its positive expression, it becomes a commitment to practice contentment with what we have. We can see it as an aspect of renunciation, of relinquishment, letting go of greed, desire for what others have. We can also see it as a form of appreciation or gratitude for what we do have, instead of perhaps a more common focusing on a sense of lack. So in this way, the precept to refrain from stealing becomes refined into an attitude of open-handed generosity. And in retreat, we can see it as an invitation to accept the conditions as we find them, rather than trying to change them to suit our own individual wishes for comfort. And in a similar way, the precept about not using our sexual energy in harmful ways, it can be expressed positively as having respect for ourselves and others' relationships. So again, in the context of a retreat, where this precept is about maintaining celibacy, it's an opportunity to perhaps notice some of those habitual patterns that we do have around sexual energy and make the choice not to feed them. And again, we can see this as a kind of gift to other people and to ourselves, to just let other people be, instead of perhaps our usual habits of trying to get their attention or feeling like we need to behave in certain ways or take on roles or present ourselves in various ways. So even if you came here with a partner or a friend or a family member, it can be an invitation to give them the gift of silence and space for just this 1 week. And then the fourth precept, to refrain from false speech during retreat, it's the commitment to maintain noble silence. And I know for myself what a powerful act of renunciation it can be to relinquish the phones and the devices, to put them aside, because many of us do have quite an addictive relationship to technology these days, so much so that some Dharma teachers are saying that this should be included in the fifth precept of not taking intoxicants. So when we put aside our phones, as we're going to do shortly, we might notice the strength of that kind of compulsive energy. Speaking for myself again. And sometimes when we enter more fully into this noble silence, what we start to hear more loudly is our inner dialogue, the ways that we talk to ourselves. And again, as a refinement of this precept, we might start to notice, how do I speak to myself? If I'm serious about this invitation towards non-harming, I might think, listen to that inner language and see, is this harsh speech? Is it beneficial speech? Is it true speech? And again, speaking for myself, I've been surprised at times at how that inner dialogue is not always in alignment with this precept about harsh speech. So making the intention to cultivate kind speech, even in our inner dialogue, is another way of refining this precept. And then the fifth one, to refrain from taking intoxicants, and just to say this refers to recreational type intoxicants, it doesn't refer to prescription medication. So if you're on prescriptions, then by all means, please follow them. What we're talking about here is more like alcohol and other substances that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness, is the traditional phrase. So we start with this basic commitment to refrain from consuming intoxicants, but we can refine it to notice what are we consuming, what are we ingesting, not only in terms of substances, but say books that we read or TV shows that we watch, movies, entertainment, tech devices, all of those things have an effect on our hearts and minds. So that's a fairly brief overview of these five precepts and the invitation to refine them, not only from abstaining, but moving them towards their more positive expressions. And I'd like to invite us to take them together now formally in call and response. So I'll name each one out loud, and then if you like, you're invited to make the commitment together. So the first one, I undertake the training precept to abstain from killing living beings. I undertake the training precept to abstain from killing living beings. The second one, I undertake the training precept to abstain from taking what is not given. I undertake the training precept to abstain from taking what is not given. The third one, I undertake the training precept to abstain from misconduct regarding sexuality. I undertake the training precept to abstain from misconduct regarding sexuality. The fourth one, I undertake the training precept to abstain from false speech. I undertake the training precept to abstain from false speech. And the fifth one, I undertake the training precept to abstain from the carelessness caused by intoxicants. I undertake the training precept to abstain from the carelessness caused by intoxicants. Thank you. So we've set up some outer supports for our practice. And I'd like to take just a few more minutes now to explore some of the internal supports, qualities of mind that can really help to establish a good foundation for our meditation practice. And the first of these is a quality of goodwill or kindness or metta, to use the Pali word that these teachings were originally translated in. And metta is basically an open and receptive state of heart and mind, an attitude of kind curiosity towards ourselves and others, towards every aspect of our experience. And later in the retreat, we'll be doing some formal metta meditation practice, these guided meditations that help to reinforce this attitude of goodwill. But for now, I'm just inviting you to remember it as an inner attitude, an invitation to meet whatever your experience is right now with kindness rather than resistance. So for example, even right now, you might notice what's happening in the body. And perhaps there's a slight trace of some kind of discomfort, some stiffness or tiredness or tension, or perhaps more pleasant sensations of warmth or lightness or ease. Whatever is happening in your body right now, can you just bring this attitude of kindness to it? Oh, backache is like this. It's okay. Sleepiness is like this. It's okay. Yawning is like this. It's okay. And then how about the mind, the heart mind? I often like to use this phrase heart mind rather than just mind, because in English the word mind is associated with the intellect. But my understanding is that in Pali and most Asian languages, the word that we translate as mind usually includes emotions too. So we can think of heart mind as including our thoughts, our emotions, our moods, our mind states. And you might like to check right now what's happening in the heart and the mind. Perhaps anxiety or boredom or self-judgment, or perhaps curiosity, interest, enthusiasm. Whatever your mental experiences right now, can you meet that with kindness? So no matter what the experience is in each moment, we're developing this capacity to simply be with it without resistance. And this is how I think of metta or goodwill, as a receptivity to the full spectrum of our experience. So as best you can, seeing if you can let go of any sense of getting it right or fear of getting it wrong, and just explore and enjoy. I'd actually like to offer that as a mantra for all of your time on retreat here. Explore and enjoy. See if you can actually have fun over the next few days, as you explore and enjoy whatever your experience might be, rather than thinking in terms of right and wrong or success and failure. Simply explore and enjoy. So we have a container for our practice through the commitment to the precepts and noble silence. We have this invitation to cultivate an inner attitude of kindness to our experience. And a second quality of mind that's very powerful in supporting our meditation practice is the quality of aspiration or intention. To really have clarity about what we're putting our time and energy into can really help us make the most of it. So as a support for getting that clarity about what we're doing here, I wanted to take a little bit of time just to take some time in silence to just check in and see if you can connect with what brought you here to this retreat. To see if you can get clarity about what you hope to get from your time here over the next week. And just as importantly, what you hope to bring to this experience. Perhaps, for example, an open heart and mind, or an attitude of kindness, or whatever it might be. And sometimes it can be helpful to make this aspiration more clear by writing it down. So I invited each of you to get yourself a piece of colored paper and a pen. And after a couple of moments of silence, you might like to just write whatever came up for you, and then you're invited to fold it and bring it and put it into this bowl here. And at the same time, as a double act of offering, you might like to bring your phone turned off, because it's going to be in my room for safekeeping. Put your name on your phone and offer that in at the same time. So to begin with, let's just take one or two moments of silence to just take a moment to pause and to tune in. To bring the awareness to the heart. And see if you can connect with your aspiration for being here over this week. What you'd like to receive from being here, and what you might offer or bring to this week of retreat. If you like, you're invited to just jot down what may have come up and then bring it as an offering for this bowl and an invitation to relinquish your phone at the same time. Okay, so now we have all of these conditions in place. We have this bowl of aspirations. It's kind of like flowers. And I leave them here at the front so you can have a visual reminder of our collective aspirations for this retreat. So I think we're ready now to do some actual practice. And I know all of you have at least some previous meditation practice. So just as a very simple definition of this form of meditation, insight meditation or vipassana, it's a way of training the heart and the mind to see clearly. And we use mindfulness as a method to gain insight into what's happening in our lives, so that we can live in ways that bring more ease and happiness and freedom. So that's a 1 second description of an entire lifetime of practice. But we're fortunate that the path that the Buddha laid out is a gradual one. It's laid out in stages so that we progress from quite simple instructions to increasingly refined and subtle ones. And we'll be following that, you could think of it, curriculum, as a curriculum over the course of this retreat, exploring some of the key techniques of insight practice, all coming from the core text that all these insight teachings come from, which is the Satipatthana Sutta, or the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in English, sometimes translated as the Four Establishments of mindful awareness, or the four domains of attention. So we'll be starting at the beginning and working through these four foundations. And tonight I'll offer just a short guided meditation, bringing awareness to the body and to the breath. And because most of us arrive at the start of a retreat with some degree of busyness or agitation, perhaps anxiety, restlessness, tension, I'll offer a short body scan with the invitation to relax what can be relaxed. And there may be aspects of tension that can't be relaxed, that's okay. But this is just an invitation to see if we can begin to arrive here, to settle and to release whatever might be released.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.